Hey, Jamie.
Hey.
How are you?
I'm doing fine.
I don't know if you saw my text about being late.
I did. I answered it.
You did?
I did.
Oh, I didn't think you did. Oh, yeah. I see it now. Didn't make much of a blip on my phone.
Well, I don't know.
So, Jamie, how have you been?
I've been fine. Thank you for asking. How have you been?
Pretty good.
I missed you, Mike.
I missed you too, Jamie. Michelle filled in for you last week, and she really shined because she picked up on something that I totally missed.
Well, on the show. I will tell you that I listened to the podcast that you guys did, and I was really impressed. I thought Michelle did a fantastic job, and I think I know the one you're talking about, but tell me.
Well, the baseball cards.
That's right. And, you know, when I was listening to the podcast, I agreed with Michelle. I thought that it was really legit that he wanted those baseball
cards. But that's so stupid. That makes that guy such an idiot.
He is an idiot.
Well, he's a spaz, but he seems smarter than that. I mean, why the hell is he worried about what is he, a 45-year-old, 8-year-old?
Well, yeah, kind of.
God.
What did I think it was Nacho who said the thing about, what is it, 60-year-old, 6-year-old or something?
Yeah, for 6-year-olds riding in a school bus for 6-year-olds or something.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, I mean, that's that dude. He's, come on. He's riding around in that horrible, very extremely noticeable car. He can't be too smart.
That's not the first time Michelle's picked up on something that I was so totally convinced that she was so being so silly and wrong about. Mm-hmm. Oh, Michelle, how can you not see that they're not after the baseball cards? He's luring them in to get – because it would have been smart for him to lure them in just to see where they are with Nacho. Like, hey, could you get my baseball cards and just find out if they could find a fingerprint of somebody or – Yeah. But why would you invite the cops into your own house when you're, like, running a crime empire, a mini-empire, and have a chance of them finding something or just recognizing something for a stupid freaking baseball card collection?
He's a doofus.
What do you think the baseball cards were worth compared to each time he sold those drugs to Nacho?
Oh, I don't know. Well, I mean, okay, so a baseball card collection could be worth really a whole lot of money. But I don't know. But he had like a Mickey Mantle in there, and he had like a bunch of really like fantastic ones, and they were apparently in mint condition because he talked about, you know, how good a condition they were, and they'd never been exposed to air or something in the other episode. So probably very valuable, but I can't imagine how much comparatively.
Or fluorescent light. Can't do his voice very well, but yeah. But maybe, do you think he bought the cards with the money from the drugs? Because he bought the Hummer. He's not dealing baseball cards to make all his money. He's dealing drugs to make his money.
No, and in fact, he didn't want to sell a single one of those cards because they all meant so much to him. And, you know, having his dad, you know, have owned a piece of them, I don't think he was trying to get rid of those cards at all. No,
he... Yeah, that's true. He doesn't mention that they were his dad's property.
Yeah.
Anyway, Michelle, you get the props, man. I was wrong. Totally wrong about that.
Yay, Michelle.
All right, Jamie. So this is West Coast Project, in case you've forgotten. It's been so long since you've been on here.
Yeah, I sort of remember.
And this is Better Call Saul, the feed on West Coast Project. And we're going to start with Chuck playing Sicilian. Have you ever heard of that composition, Jamie?
Okay, so no. I had never heard of it before, but I looked it up. And it's really fascinating. Did you look it up?
I looked it up, but I couldn't find anything fascinating about it.
Okay, so it's really cool because he's playing this musical piece, Sicilian, by this French composer named Gabriel Fauré. And it was originally published as a violin or cello solo with piano accompaniment.
Duh, who doesn't know that?
And it's pretty rare for a piece of music that old to have that sort of an odd construction, but it is. And sometimes that particular piece of music is arranged for piano accompaniment by a harp or a guitar, which figures into the show later. So it's really, really cool. And actually, this piece was written as something called incidental music. And incidental music is what they use in television shows and plays and that sort of thing as sort of like a background kind of, you know, music that's not really meant to be noticed very much. And it's comparable to like film score. So that I thought was really interesting because it's kind of like how it's being used a little bit. And if you think of it that way, the way that Chuck is playing it, if you think of it as incidental music, that makes the whole rest of the scene like really, that's like the front of what we should actually be paying attention to and noticing. And it was so cool because, you know, when the scene opens, you know, he's sitting there getting ready to play this music. He puts the sheet music on the piano and he opens the metronome and sets it to going. And then the camera pulls back and you get this, the picture. It's a photo in a frame of Chuck and Jimmy when they're babies. They're like little. And so if you know what the music means, then you know that, and you know what's going to happen later in the episode, right? Like we know with our second watch that this piece that Chuck is playing, he is playing the accompanying piece of it, the main part, which is the string instrument, the cello or the harp or the guitar. That's the main part of the piece of music. So he's trying to play, but he's only the side piece. And the main part would be Jimmy, because Jimmy talks later about him picking up the guitar when he was in high school and trying to learn how to play it and then giving it up because he wanted to chase girls. And so I think that that whole scene is about Chuck not being able to really feel like a whole person without Jimmy, that he feels empty and he can't even play the music. The music of, you know, his existence is not really full without Jimmy.
Well, that's an awesome take, Jamie. I thought it had something to do with Clifford playing the guitar later, but so I guess that's an awesome take. So Chuck's not good at being the side piece. His role is the main focus of everything, and he's not going to be good at being the side piece. And is that what you're saying? That he's got this disdain for Jimmy if he ever were to take over the main center stage, as it were.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's kind of like what the situation is now, because, you know, if you look at the scene, the way it's set, Chuck is just like alone in his house and it's like really dark in there and he can't get anything done. He can't even play this piece of music without Jimmy. And Jimmy, in the meantime, is, you know, on the main stage, you know, sort of having his moment in the sun. And Chuck is off to the side by himself. And actually that piece of music was written as incidental music for a very specific play. It was called Le Bourgeois Gentilhomme, which is it's a French play, and it's got an oxymoronic title. It means middle class nobleman, basically, is what that means. And it's about social climbing. And you know, when Jimmy goes into that guy's office who's playing the guitar,
Clifford, yeah.
Clifford's office. When he goes in there, he says, you know, oh, this is all kind of brand new to me. And he looks kind of out of place, kind of uncomfortable, like he doesn't really know what to do with his arms. And, you know, he just looks awkward. And that's a throwback. It's a reference to the play.
Interesting. Well, Jamie, you're coming back in style. You came back like a burst of storm here on the podcast scene. Because when's the last time you and I did a podcast?
Okay, so we did something not too long ago.
We did do something, didn't we? I can't remember what. But that was a pretty good, strong burst of brilliance there. I'm proud of you.
Thank you.
Chuck does live in the gloom tomb, as Michael Rapaport would call it, the gloom tomb. His house is just miserable looking. And Howard, when he comes in, so we do see that, just to go kind of back on track of what happens sequentially here. Howard comes in with the grocery run, and he's honest with Chuck, but he's afraid of Chuck.
Yes, he is.
Shall tell he's afraid of Chuck. So yeah, that was pretty interesting. With your take on that, that does make that scene, because they put a lot of time into that metronome scene with the piano, good two or three minutes. So the next scene, though, is Kim rearranging the seats at the conference table so that Jimmy will sit near her.
Yes.
And then play sexy footy with him during the boring times of I guess they're just considering the trial and the facts and putting their case together there at the conference room.
Well, I don't know if it was sexy footy. I thought it was kind of affectionate footy.
Encouragement.
Well, and I think she really likes him. You know, I don't think it's just like a, you know, like a sex thing with those two. I think that they really have affection for each other, because sexy footy would have been kind of like, you know, shoe off with the toenail polish and that kind of thing, tracing his leg or something. But it was really kind of just like her putting her leg, you know, sideways and kind of rolling her ankle. And that's kind of like a schoolgirl kind of footy thing. I thought it was adorable.
Yeah, I got it. And I got an important question for you later on about this that is, I think, really important to this series, this situation with Jimmy. I mean, it's obvious. Everyone's going to be thinking this already, but we can talk about it. So after this meeting in the conference room, they go outside and smoke. It's reminiscent of the very first time we saw Jimmy in Better Call Saul. Jimmy with this beautiful blonde girl in the garage, like, what's he doing with her? And
right.
We find out that they're... in fact, do you think that scene was almost a replication of it? It looked exactly like that scene, that very first scene when we were introduced to the series.
Yeah, I do, actually. I think that it was on purpose, very purposefully constructed. I think this entire episode was that way. And I hate to interrupt you right now, but I really, there are some things I want to say. And so one of them is, there are a couple of things that I noticed about Saul, about like the series, that I wanted to note, that I sort of gone into and looked into, you know, while we were on hiatus. And so
yeah,
one of the things, one of the things is the theme song, the theme music for Better Call Saul. In the episode of Breaking Bad called Better Call Saul, when Saul is introduced and, oh gosh, the character, what's his name? Badger. When Badger is sitting on the bench, on the park bench, and he's waiting for the guy to come by to get the bag of drugs. What's that guy's name? It's like
Jimmy In-N-Out or something.
Yeah, Jimmy In-N-Out. So he's waiting for Jimmy In-N-Out to come by. The incidental music in that scene is the theme music for Better Call Saul, but it's just set at a different speed. Like, it's a different...
Now, how the hell did you ever find that out?
Because I went back and I was watching Breaking Bad, and I heard it.
Wow. But to recognize it at a different speed?
Well, I mean, okay, you would hear it. Like, if you were listening to it, it wasn't something special that I did. You would hear it, but if you... you would only notice it if you knew the theme music for Better Call Saul.
Huh. So it's a slide guitar kind of... Is it slower or faster?
It's slower.
Huh. Interesting.
Yeah. And it's a different arrangement. It's not the same, but it's just... You know, it's the same tune, but it's not the same instruments or anything like that. I think the one in Breaking Bad is a bit fuller composition. This one, the one that we have for the theme song for Better Call Saul, is a bit more pared back, as far as I remember. Okay, and so then the other thing that I wanted to mention is about the reference to Miho in this episode. And then also, like, of course, in the first season of Better Call Saul, the first episode was called Miho, right? And it was a reference to Tuco. Well, I was rewatching Breaking Bad, as I am wont to do, and I noticed that there was an episode. I think it was after Tuco was dead. That they were out at
Spoilers.
The farm. Yeah, right. They were out at the farm with Gus, and Tio was there. And I want to say it was that other Don, that guy. I can't remember who it was, but they were there at the table. And you know, Tio couldn't talk. But the guy was speaking for him, and he said he was referring to Tuco as Miho. So that was his name way back in Breaking Bad time. Like, that was his name from his family.
Yeah, that was Tuco's name.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
And so it was really kind of awesome, because in this episode, there's a reference to Miho later.
Okay. Well, good. Good catch.
Thanks.
Yeah, so another interesting thing about this garage, I thought it, you know, let's kind of get back into the scene, is their faces in the garage are lit with these really interesting shadows. Like they're all clouded and blacked out, almost if like their future is troubled or burdened by something, burdened by doubt. Like something's cast over them, cast over their future. Right. Really gloomy.
Yeah. Well, it was really interesting that I found that the contrast was really sharp, because the light that was shining was very warm but really bright sunlight, and the shadows were so very, very deep and dark. And both of them had half their faces. With Kim, it was like a diagonal, very
like a slash, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Which makes me think that that's some foreshadowing, and maybe she's going to get murdered. And, you know, Jimmy, his face was lit less, it wasn't such a sharp contrast. It was almost like, you know, like a very kind of, almost like, you know, those comedy tragedy masks. It was almost like kind of something like that, where the light was definitely dark on one side and light on the other, but it wasn't. It was curved. It was more curvy with the contours of his face. And so I thought that was really cool. But one more thing that I noticed, if we can go back just a second, when they were getting ready to have that meeting in the conference room, and this is, did they have it yet? The footy scene. Okay, so when Kim goes into the meeting room and she's getting ready to switch the books, you know, for so that she could sit next to to Jimmy. She takes that plate of pastry and just very slightly turns it to where it's at a different angle. And that's actually kind of a shout out to Vince Gilligan, because I don't know if you remember, but the episode of the Better Call Saul Insider podcast, when they had Ray Seahorn on there, she was telling a little anecdote about, you know, how exacting Vince Gilligan is. And she said in her first scene with Howard, with Patrick Fabian, who plays Howard, on the show on Better Call Saul, they were sitting at a table in this scene, like in a conference room, and Vince Gilligan apparently stopped filming. Like he stopped everything for just a moment, walked into the room, and just very slightly moved the plate of pastry to the side, and then walked out. And Ray and Patrick were looking at each other when the filming stopped, and they were like, "Oh my God, who did it? You did something wrong. I didn't do anything wrong." And it was just the plate of pastry he just wanted to move.
So, do you think that she did that as an actor in this scene, just as a nod to Gilligan, or do you think the director had her do it?
I think that the director had her do it. I think it was probably written into the episode. And I think it was just a wink at Vince Gilligan and probably, you know, a little wink at the super fans who notice things like that, who remember hearing the story kind of stuff. Because, you know, they're really, I mean, they have stepped up their game this season with not only the set composition, but the references that are in the episodes and the metaphor that's there. So I think probably it was very definitely on purpose.
Yeah, let me ask you this, Jamie, because I asked this of Michelle. Do you think this show can equal Breaking Bad?
All right, so when I heard you say that on the podcast with Michelle, I literally rolled my eyes and was like, dude, seriously? But when I was watching this episode, the composition of the scenes, my God, it was so beautiful. I mean, it was just so beautiful. The balance that was there and just the, you know, the color and the texture and the movement and everything was just stunning. It was really beautiful. And the writing was so great. I have to say, I'm buying into your theory because, you know, you've said that before. You said, whatever the last thing was that you and I recorded together, you were talking about it. We were talking about what we were looking forward to coming back. And you said, I'm looking forward to Better Call Saul the most. And I think it has potential to be even better than Breaking Bad. And even then I was like, dude, how could you think that? And now I think you might be right.
Well, it's somewhat blasphemous, I guess, because Breaking Bad was so great. But look at what they have. They have this rocket ship fueled up. they have a whole backstory or four-story or whatever we call it. They have all these interesting characters, and they have this confidence, and they have, like, the whole world kind of on the edge of their seat watching to see what they do. It's just a perfect storm for them to have just a fantastic series. I don't know. They're proving it. They're getting it, like, they're nailing it every scene, every episode, every scene.
I agree with you. I think it's really beautiful. And there's just so much. It's rich. It's really, really rich with metaphor. I could go on. I mean, even just about that first scene. There's stuff in that first scene that I haven't even talked about. I mean, it's amazing. Really, seriously. It's really, really. They are blowing it out.
All right. Well, Jimmy gets a cup from Kim, a gift, and then goes and picks up his new car. And the nail girls are really impressed with this new car, Jamie, but not the head honcho. Head honchette, whatever. Not even a goodbye hug for Jimmy.
No.
All right, so you're doing all this research. What's with the yellow? She's wearing yellow. Jimmy's old car was yellow. Price is yellow. Jesse was yellow in the beginning. What's with the yellow?
All right, Mike, I'm going to have to put you on hold for like a second. Just hold on a second, okay? Don't move. I'll be right back.
All right, Jamie's going off to the yellow, looking up the Breaking Bad yellow references in her massive notebooks of the series.
Mike, you can't give me such a hard time.
They're stacked back in her warehouse. She has to move her washing machine up and then open a little trap door. I've seen this, so, you know. And then underneath is this giant room. It's like a study, but there's all these notebooks, spiral-bound notebooks with handwritten ink. All right, what do you got, Jamie?
All right, so I do not remember if you remember this. I don't know if you remember this, but when I first met you, I was like, oh my God, you have to like listen to me and my color theory about Breaking Bad. And I actually constructed an entire color theory. Like, I have it written down, like what every single color means.
Yeah. First, before you do this, I don't want to rain on your parade, but I never liked that theory. I never liked the clothing and color theory.
Well, that's okay. You don't have to like it, because Vince Gilligan said that it wasn't on purpose. Like, he's already said that, but I have figured out the entire thing.
Yeah, I want to hear it. I want to hear what you got.
All right. So, yellow is actually fear. And it means that either the person's in fear or that they should be feared, or that they should be in fear. You know, it's like that's what the yellow represents. And I've noticed that I didn't notice it very much in the first season, but this season I'm seeing, and especially this episode, a real return to the respect for the colors. And I see them. I mean, there was a lot of blue in this episode, and the way I figured it out in the Vince Gilligan universe is that blue is protection. Because, you know, when in Breaking Bad, when Skyler was pregnant, she wore a lot of blue, and that was her original color. But then it sort of evolved throughout the series to mean protection for anybody who was wearing it. And it's the same thing here. I could go on.
Well, what about the meth being blue?
Oh, well, okay. So that's Walt's protection. Like, he's protecting his family, you know, by making this death, chemical death that he's serving to people.
Yeah, building up these resources. So what's yellow? What's the yellow mean? In this particular instance of Price, and Price is afraid of something, or Price is meant to be feared by people, or what?
No, Price should actually be in fear. And, you know, red is danger. And so he's got this huge yellow car. He should be afraid, and he is in danger. Like, he's literally, the flames are all over, the flames of danger are surrounding him. But yeah, I mean, in that scene with the nail salon lady who's wearing the yellow, and with, you know, Saul there, I'm sorry, with Jimmy, and the yellow, that whole thing is a bit of foreshadowing, because even what he says to her, this isn't goodbye, it's till we meet again.
I didn't even notice that.
Knowing Jimmy and how bad his luck is and how bad his decisions are, I think that, you know, he is going to meet her again, and she's going to just, you know, be very sort of nonchalant about it, and, you know, and kind of say, you know, basically like, I knew you'd be back or something.
Well, does he meet her in Breaking Bad? Does he come in as Saul? Is that, because that's the nail salon, right?
Yeah, I think it is. You know what? I didn't think of that, but but I don't know if she was in that. I don't know if she was in Breaking Bad, but yeah, that is the nail salon. That's the one he takes
Jesse, and Jesse just laughs it off. Like, I'm not investing in this stupid business.
Precisely.
All right. So Price leaves, Price pulls into the police department parking lot with Mike at the booth, and Mike has a little talk with him, Jamie. And tells them basically the cops are just scamming you to come in. You know, they don't care about your baseball cards. the drugs were stolen, but he's worried about these baseball cards. So we do learn in this little scene that drugs were stolen by Nacho or whoever. I guess Nacho's crew or Nacho himself, right, in addition to the baseball cards. But he's worried about those baseball cards. So, Michelle, again, props to you. I thought that was so ridiculous. And, that's what he's worried about. And Mike tries to warn him, but he's so dense and childish that Mike has to finally intervene and just say, look, I'll help you get the cards. You got to pay the price.
Right. Okay. And so here's, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, just stupid. Pardon the pun, price.
Okay. So, but that's another thing about the color, because he's wearing this super, super, super dark green shirt. That's what Price is wearing. And green, according to my theory, is someone's true nature. And the darker a color is, like, the more serious and sincere and deep, whatever that characterization is. And so he's very greedy. He's very stupid. And everything else that he's displaying in that scene is really who he essentially is.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's pretty deep stuff. I'm glad you probed that out of this.
Well, okay, so if you had listened to me a year and a half ago, we would have had this discussion then.
I know, but you know me, I never listen to my co-hosts.
Yeah, maybe.
Even in my next notes here, Jamie, I don't even mention the guitar or any of that stuff you picked on. I just have Jimmy proves his worth to Clifford going in and picking out the fact that, you know, I wondered what this scene was about, but I guess with your reference to the main plot or the main musical theme and the sub theme or side theme, that this explains it a little bit better. But Jimmy's little point here is that the opt-in feature of the Sandpiper residency was more a requirement than an opt-in, and that might give them an angle on the case. And then, like you said, he seems pretty shy with this guy, Clifford. He's like almost ashamed or afraid to offer this pretty strong piece of evidence that he's uncovered. He's got no confidence.
Right. He feels like a fish out of water. He feels like that he is, sort of climbing. He's social climbing, which is a reference to that play. And there's the main character in that play is that dude. He's like this middle class, merchant class guy whose father is very successful. And he gets to sort of, skirt the edge of being part of the nobility, but he's never there. And, so there's Jimmy. Our hero, Jimmy, and he's, there. He's like ensconced in all this fantastic, super plush life, and he doesn't really fit, and he may never fit.
Is Sicilian the name of the play?
No, it's the name of the piece of music that was composed. The name of the play is Le Bourgeois Gentilhomme. That is my best French accent.
Well, nobody's going to jump on you for that. That sounds like you nailed it.
Oh, thank you.
All right, Jamie, you got more? Got more in that?
I always have.
How many acts were in that play?
I don't know.
What?
Sorry. But there was something that I was going to add, and you actually made me forget. So,
oh, I'm sorry.
It's okay.
Well, I'll plow ahead, and you can stop me whenever you come up with something smarter than my mundane recollections. So Mike finds Nacho at his dad's upholstery shop. And I thought this, Jamie, this was Mike proving his worth, even though we kind of knew it already, but proving it to Nacho, maybe. And he says, well, how'd you find me? Like, he's pretty impressed, almost a little scared. Like, wow, this is not what I thought was going to happen. And, Jamie, did you wonder where this shop was? I thought maybe it might even be somewhere in Mexico, like Juarez or somewhere. And I looked up to see how far Albuquerque is from, like, Juarez or the Mexican border. It's pretty far.
Oh,
it's like,
yeah,
200 plus miles. It's too far to be. It's, so it's probably Albuquerque or somewhere in the outskirts of Albuquerque.
Yeah, no, I definitely thought that it was in the city. I thought it was, you know, local. But I thought it was really, really, really great. Like the difference between because there was such a contrast between the two scenes. You know, there was a beautiful plush office over at Davis and Main, and then, you know, you switched to this really awful, like, sweatshop like scene, you know, where Nacho's dad's business is. And I thought that was great. But this is the reference that I was going to actually make, which is in that scene, Nacho's father at least three or four times calls him mijo. And I just thought it was so great because, you know, if he had only done it once, maybe twice, you know, that would be, you know, understandable. And it probably wouldn't be something that we should perk up our ears and take as a reference. But I think because he said it so many times that it was definitely for us to say, oh, look, there's that tie into Tuca.
So, and Jamie, while you were giving that great explanation, I looked it up on the Urban Dictionary. Mijo means my son.
Yeah, it does.
So it's and it may not necessarily be like genetically your son, but maybe an older person just saying it to somebody that they care about, right?
Right, and it's a common expression in Spanish. But I know, like, knowing these guys, these writers, they wouldn't do that on just like by incident. If he were just going to call him mijo, he'd call him maybe once, maybe twice. But the number of times that he did it, and the fact that Tuco was actually referenced in this episode, and the fact that Tuco is mijo, both in Better Call Saul and in Breaking Bad, I think it's trivia. I think Jenny Hutcheson wrote it in there for a reason.
Yeah, there's for sure nothing done just by chance in this.
Yeah.
All right, so Mike's got a carrot and stick situation, Jamie.
Yep.
And Nacho doesn't take to that very well. He's like, okay, you want to show me the stick, old man? What do you got? But Mike's smarter than that. He wants to offer up more of the carrot than the stick. Although he says Tuco could have been a stick, because Tuco, knowing that Nacho was selling drugs on the side, would have been bad news for Nacho.
That's right.
So he offers up the carrot, and or he's about to anyway. And it kind of shifts. We shift now to Chuck back in his powerless house, nothing powered in there. And Ernesto now is bringing in more supplies. Does this guy get a grocery shipment every day? He gets lots of stuff from people bringing it in. I don't go shopping that much myself. And I have refrigerators and stuff.
Okay, so I think that a part of it is that Howard came by maybe with some groceries. He did come by with groceries, but I think that his main reason was to inform Chuck that, you know, that Jimmy is employed by Davis and Main, and, you know, in order to sort of take some of the heat off himself, because like what you were saying, he's scared of Chuck. And he, you know what he did? He kind of threw Kim under the bus and said, you know, she really pushed hard for this, but I didn't stand in the way. Like,
right, he tempers it a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah, so, yeah, I think that's why he got two deliveries.
So Chuck puts on his aluminum-lined suit and gets ready to go in.
Yeah.
So the next scene, Jamie, Price gives up the Hummer.
Yep.
But it's only going to be chopped up. He's trying to give special care instructions how to take care of that baby. But it just breaks his heart when he learns that it's going to be chopped up, not going to be loved and owned by somebody. It's going to be owned by 500 people. But he gets his cards back, and Aaron, Jeter, and Mantle are all in the right places. He knows right where to look for them in the catalog of cards he has. He's such a dope. He's like a brilliant dope. He's like a super smart dope, because he works for a drug firm as some IT somebody, Right, and he's got it enough together enough to be able to get these drugs out of there and make some money and get away with it for a while at least. So he's got some intelligence.
Yeah, he's got intelligence, but he's so, you know, when we met Price last season, I said, you know, he's got his, you know, his Sunday polo or his Saturday weekend polo he's wearing and his, you know, Dockers and that kind of stuff. He's so soft and he's so suburban and he's an idiot because he's, okay, how can I put this? All right. Very middle class sort of, you know, majority type people have a flavor about them. There's a sense of entitled safety and expectation that goes along with being a person who's a member of the majority and who has a very sort of comfortable life where nothing is really dangerous for them. And this dude is the epitome of that. He walks around the world thinking he's safe when he's actually walking on the edge of a cliff. And that, I mean, it's such a great characterization. I love it. And that's his problem. He thinks that he's safe. And he thinks that he's smart. And, you know, he buys his own hype.
I don't agree, Jamie. Price is a player. It even says so on his license plate.
All right.
No, you're right. He's a simpleton. He's like a really smart guy, but he doesn't have an iota of street smarts.
There you go.
I mean, any idiot would know not to drive around in anything ostentatious like this car with the matching yellow tennis shoes.
And watch. His watch matched, too.
Yeah, his watch band. What a dope.
Right.
All right. So where are we? Price gives it up, gets the cards back, and Nacho tells him, and now our business is concluded. So is Price done for? Is it going to be – I mean, we see him a little bit more in this, but is he going to be in a hole in the desert somewhere? Or is he just a faded character arc that just drifts away?
Yeah, I think he may be done at least for a while. He may return because, I think that Gilligan and crew get a kick out of, you know, bringing us back old characters who are amusing or interesting for some other reason. And so we may see him again.
Yeah, he's like a badger. He's the badger of this series. You know, funny and fun to look at, and he's a good distraction from the serious crime criminal stuff, but he's very interesting too. He's not just stupid. It's stupid funny, stupid interesting.
Right.
Okay, so Jimmy's now back at the lawyer's den, and he gives his take on the resources of how the elderly are a vault of resources. They keep everything, Jamie. They don't throw anything away, and they have ribbon candy. And this is where Chuck comes in. What is ribbon candy, by the way? Have you ever had it?
Oh, yeah. Okay.
It's like so, roll-ups or what?
No. You know how at Christmas time, they have those big giant cans of like candy and they look like ribbons, like they look like satin and they have like, and they're curly sometimes, you know, like, it's like, you know, have you ever seen taffy being pulled, how it looks like it gets all stretched out and ribbony and looks kind of satiny? Well, that's what ribbon candy looks like. It's hard candy, but it looks really beautiful and curved. It's really pretty.
I can picture everything you just described, but I've never been aware of that or heard of that or seen it like in a person's living room or something or Christmas setting. What, it's in like a bowl of candy and you just pick it out and eat it?
All right, so you're in front of your computer. Just type in ribbon candy and you'll see it. A big picture comes up. It's really pretty. And yeah, you can keep it in a bowl or keep it in a can. The ones that I've seen, they come in a can most often. And there's more variety than what you see when you Google it right now and it'll pop up. But yeah, it's old-fashioned hard candy.
Sounds awful, and it actually looks interesting, but it doesn't look like that good to eat. It doesn't look appetizing.
It's delicious. Depends on the flavor you get. It's delicious.
It's like sugar, though. It's like pure raw sugar.
Sort of, yeah.
All right, well, now Chuck comes in after this phone game and stops the confidence, just shuts Chuck shuts Jimmy right down. Jimmy can't bear to see Chuck in the room. The phone game being everybody have to hand up their cell phones and key fobs and everything. Mm-hmm. But the hand on the knee puts Jimmy right back on track. This really does make Kim and Jimmy look like they're good for each other, because she gives him this confidence and support. She cares about him, and it works for him. It makes him feel more confident. So that was a cool scene. I like that. I like that more than the footy scene.
Yeah, that was better.
So Chuck talks to Jimmy afterwards, and to bear witness. What a dick. To bear witness to what, Jamie? To him failing or to him succeeding? It certainly didn't seem like, I want to bear witness to your success, James. I want to see you fail, is what it seemed like.
Yeah. I mean, you know, Chuck is an ass. And, you know, and he didn't say that in a way that made it clear, you know, that he was proud. And, of course, he showed his teeth to Jimmy last season. And so we know, I mean, he's an asshole. He's not going to be nice, and he won't be happy for him. He's there to bear witness to the train wreck that he expects to happen with Jimmy.
So with the exquisite timing that these writers have, this is where Mike calls in and asks Jimmy if he's morally flexible and offers him a job for this whole situation with Price. And Jimmy, yeah, of course, this taps right into what he needs. Like, screw this lawyer game. I'll go do this other thing that I am important in, and people do recognize me as valuable. Interesting, though. The timing was really sweet. I thought how they made these two scenes mesh together. So Price is in jail talking to the detective. Not in jail, but he's talking to the detectives, and he's just saying pretty clumsily, hey, no problem, guys. We're good. I found the cards, and... everything's, you know, everything I was worried about is don't have to worry about it anymore. Just shut the case. And, he tries to clumsily do that. And Jimmy sits there and listens to it for a minute, but he has to eventually excuse Price. And then he takes control. Mm-hmm. Pretty another dark scene here. Literally the scene in the interrogation room was dark. What do you think the meaning of that was?
Well, I mean, you know, it's a police station. And, you know, there was danger there, and, you know, any kind of, you know, production, of any sort, darkness, you know, is, you know, an indicator of, you know, actually like emotional, metaphorical darkness. Physical darkness, is the same, you know, as metaphorical darkness. So that's what I think. I think, you know, it was a dark scene, and, you know, there was potential for danger, and there was a lot of light and shadow in that scene as well. You know, the cops were sort of, you know, covered in shadow, which, you know, sort of indicated to me that they were shady.
Yeah. So Peter Gould and the writers and Gillian, whoever the hell's writing this episode, do what they've done before a lot of times in Breaking Bad and in Better Call Saul. They offer up a little bit of truth, and it makes it seem like the things you say after you say this little bit of truth, a little admission that you're being truthful. So Jimmy offers up the hidey hole. I know you guys know about the hidey hole. Let's just put that on the table. Let's talk turkey. And he spins it then that in that little hidey hole was video of Price that he was doing for some art patron that was a freaky sex, some sexy freak guy that wanted video of Price sitting in a pie. And yeah, it makes it funny, but it makes it believable. Like, okay, I can see why nobody would, you wouldn't want anybody to see that or know that about you. You'd make a little hiding place for it. It's
right.
It's ludicrous and believable because it's so inexplicable and therefore
it's like
unarguable.
Right. I mean, it's like Jimmy says. He says, would I make this up?
The Hoboken squat cobbler. Come on, guys. Boston cream splat. You know this. He makes it sound like they should know all this stuff. Anyway, he paints it like Price sits on this apple cobbler, apple pie, I guess, and wiggles and cries. And somebody makes a video of it, or he makes a video of himself doing it. Mm-hmm. No big deal, no big crime. It's kind of like Walt's fugue state. Like, it's, you can't explain it, right? You can't go, you didn't have a fugue state. It's too mysterious to explain. You got to just accept it and can't argue against it.
Right.
It's brilliant.
it's too bizarre and specific and incredible for anyone to actually make it up. That's the whole thing. And that when Skylar confronted Walt about that, she said, you know, who would lie about such a thing?
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of this. But I wanted to tell you, Ginny Hutchison is the person who wrote this episode. And she is the person who wrote the I Am the Danger speech that Walt made that everybody who watched Breaking Bad blew up about and just thought it was the best thing ever. She wrote that. And she wrote this episode.
Yeah, that's pretty iconic. That's a brilliant piece of writing.
Yeah.
Well, now Price has to actually make this video to back it up, Jamie. And trust me, you don't want to see it.
No, I don't.
So Jimmy goes and gets pies. He brings 6 pies and exchanges all this story with Kim. He's walking into their house with 6 pies. Pretty funny. But the problem is because he made Price do the video, that it's falsifying evidence. And Kim asks Jimmy why. Jamie, why? Why would Jimmy? This is where we got to start thinking about important answers to this, because we've been kind of joking around. Why is Jimmy doing this?
Okay, so, you know, I went nuts last week. I was a little annoyed because I wanted to say so much about the last episode. And this kind of ties into it because at the end of the episode, when Jimmy is just all set, he's in his office, he's got his Coca Bolo desk. By the way, you know that there's a reference to that in Breaking Bad. Do you remember that? Yeah.
No.
Saul actually talks about a Coca Bolo desk on Breaking Bad. But anyway, so he's in the office, his office, and there's that light switch on the wall that says, "Leave on, don't ever turn off," or something like that. And this idiot pulls the thing off. He pulls the label and the tape and everything off and just instantly switches off the switch.
I would have done that too, though.
Oh my God, Mike, seriously?
Yeah, you want to know there's... why? Why is it? Why must it always be on?
Oh, dude. All right, so I don't know if I'm just a rule follower, but I would never have done that. You just don't know. You don't know what's going to happen as a result. And see, this is his downfall. This is Jimmy's downfall. His downfall is that he doesn't recognize he's reckless. That's his problem. He's reckless. He doesn't recognize danger or risk when it's there, or else he doesn't value safety enough, you know, and the things that he actually has that are good. It's like he's blind to those things.
This is the crux of this whole series. And here we are in season 2, episode 2. Who knows how long it'll go into the future, but we know what happens in the future. I mean, look what he has now. He has his brilliant career path. He's got his lover, his best friend, who seems to have somewhat of a planned future with him, at least short term, probably long term. He's got, you know, he's kind of freed himself from the shadow of his brother. He's got the path cleared out in front of him. He's broken free from Chicago and Cicero and the guy who's the guy, Marco, that he used to pull all the stupid stunts with. He's got a really serious, he grew up and he has this path now. What's going to be Jimmy's downfall? Why does this all go south? Is it just that he doesn't recognize a good thing and he fucks it up?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that's a big piece of it. Because if you look at I wanted to tell you, you and Michelle were talking about Jimmy's pinky ring last episode of our podcast. And I wanted to tell you that that was actually a gift from Marco's mom. She gave Jimmy that ring as a remembrance of Marco.
Oh, okay.
And he actually has not rid himself of Marco. He's got Marco on his finger. Like, that is the representation of his past and, you know, of all of the things that he has done, you know, and he keeps that ring on. That's a reminder.
Yeah, I guess so. I remember Marco, when he died of whatever, the heart attack or seizure or whatever, his hand twitching and the ring was on his finger there and on the ground on the street. So, yeah, that's a sign of Marco.
Yeah,
I don't know, but this seems so important that when things are all going so well for Jimmy, that why did he intentionally blow it up? Did it get blown up underneath him, or did something else happen? It's his life is just paved perfectly now.
Well, okay, you know people like that. You know, there are people like that. You know, in the world, there are lots of them who either, you know, for whatever reason, they don't feel deserving, you know, of whatever it is that they get that's good. And so they mess it up.
They sabotage it. Yeah.
Yeah.
I've heard that before. It's hard to go through the steps of how it actually transpires, though. That's why that prompts this question. Like, what? It has to be something else, right? That Mike does something, that Jimmy has to get. It's a slippery slope. Or does Jimmy just blow it up? Does Jimmy just say, screw this great thing I have? It's not me. I want to do something else.
Okay. So, on the actual, like the cover for the disc for the for Better Call Saul season one. It's a picture of Saul walking across the street, but the street is actually on like an almost like I'd say probably a 75 degree tilt, and he's trying to cross the street, but he's going like up, like almost like he's climbing stairs, but he's climbing the road, and that kind of, you know, epitomizes his situation. He's always trying to climb out of something.
That's season two, though, right? That's his. That's the preview picture of this season.
Oh, is it? Because I'm looking at it. Maybe. I'm sorry, Mike. What I'm seeing is the. Yeah, it must be. No. Well, okay. So what I'm seeing is a picture, and they're talking about the first episode date was February 8th, 2015. And so it may be the one that's for this season, but that's the picture for that little IMDb shot. So.
Yeah, I think that's this season, though, because season one, he's at the phone booth in the middle of nowhere in the desert. And this season, he's crossing the street up on that steep angle.
Oh, okay. All right.
I'm pretty sure that's what it is.
Yeah, you're probably right.
So, Jamie, do you think Jimmy's transition, as it were, will be as monumental as Walt's transition? I mean, it seems like it's teed up to be. We know where he is and we know where he ends up. That's an equal path as Walt.
Okay, well, Saul Goodman is like a really comical character. He's got some gravity. He definitely has gravity. And I love Bob Odenkirk because he plays such a full range of characterizations. But I don't think that it's going to be as serious a transformation, but I believe that that it's a path. I think that you referenced that earlier in last season in one of our podcasts. We were talking about it, and I just eschewed it. I thought it was so silly. I actually said I said Vince Gilligan did that once. He won't do it again. He won't take that linear path. But it seems to me as though, even though this path is not linear, that it's definitely an evolution. It's, you know, he's definitely going to go down this tunnel, you know, toward, you know, becoming Saul Goodman. You know, that's the way it's going to work.
Yeah, and this whole world disappears for him. There's no nice, cushy desk, and he's thrown out rotten Cinnabons now in Omaha. This world that he has now disappears faster than Albuquerque shifting into Omaha. This Albuquerque to Jimmy in Albuquerque. I mean, those are three separate worlds. Mm-hmm. Jimmy McGill with Clifford Maine is different than Saul Goodman is different than whatever his name is, Gene the Cinnabon guy.
Right. You know, I really wish that I had been able to record that episode. Because I loved that scene so much.
Which one?
The one with Gene in at the cinema and cleaning up and then getting locked into that area, the trash area where he was stuck. I just thought it was so great. And I thought that the things that you noticed were really, really great. And there were things that I noticed that I don't, there were a couple of them that I don't remember you guys talking about, and now I can't remember what they were. But I'll post them like on Twitter or something. But yeah,
I remember what, like, Brooks was here. He carves his name on the wall, like, but, Shawshank.
Mm-hmm.
What else? That he was afraid that even open the door that the police would just let him back in. Who cares? You're the manager of the Cinnabon. And what's the difference between that and the police just walking in at middle of the afternoon for a donut and seeing his face?
Right. Well, I mean, okay. So I think that a direct, you know, involvement with the police, and they're just looking at his face, and it's in a situation where there's, you know, he's alone and it's a potentially criminal sort of situation, I think it would be a lot different.
Maybe.
You know, but it does sort of put in your mind, it reminds you that, you know, Gene, as hidden out as Gene is, you know, he is Saul. Like, Saul is his soul. And, you know, he carves that on the wall because he just hates not being who he really
is. And he's in as much of a jail as he would have been if he had just gotten caught and was put in a county jail in Albuquerque or whatever the penitentiary is in New Mexico.
Yeah, that's right.
Can't even walk out a door. All right. Well, that's it, Jamie. That's 202 Cobbler. Next week is 203 Amarillo. And that's it for Better Call Saul on West Coast Project. Jamie, I'm glad you're back. I miss talking to you, and I miss having your great insights. And, you know, we get into it on The Americans and Better Call Saul. And it's funny because Michelle and I have our set time of the year, and you and I have our set time of the year, and they don't really cross paths too much.
Wow, that's really cool. I guess it works out for you, right?
No, but it's not. I miss you guys. I miss your, you know, just talking to you now. We haven't spoken that much, and it just reminds me of how much input you give to this and how, you know, how much insight you give to it. Hey, are you going to come on Making a Murderer and do some of those with me?
I am. And, oh, let me tell our audience, this is the darkest show you've ever seen. Mike, you have no idea, people, how dark Mike can actually go. And
I didn't do anything to make the show. I just report on it.
He literally couldn't find another soul in existence to do this show with him. That's how dark it is. And somehow I got shoehorned into it. So.
Well, my niece did it with me. She did a great job. She did it last week with me.
Oh, that's awesome. I didn't even know you had a niece.
Well, I got lots of people you don't know about, Jamie.
Oh, by the way, did you see that I endorsed you? Did you check LinkedIn?
Through my LinkedIn Cinnabon manager job?
Yeah.
Well, maybe my name isn't really Mike.
It might not be.
If the door gets locked on me, though, I just push it open and walk out. I don't care if the police come. I'm not that worried.
Yeah, that sounds about right. All right, so you didn't put up my picture, did you?
Put up your picture?
Yeah, on West Coast Project, the one that you had to put up there.
I don't put up anybody's picture. Jamie, you could put your picture up. Michelle puts hers up if she wants. She has her picture on, I think, her Skype or her Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
You could, you know, I don't control that, though. She does it if she wants to.
No, I was talking about that picture that you judged for me.
Oh, no, of course not.
You know, I didn't think you would. That would be terrible.
I think you asked me to delete it, and I deleted it right away.
Oh, you're so sweet. Thank you.
So did it work for you?
It did. It totally worked.
Jamie, we should tell people so they don't go, what the hell are they talking about? You put up this picture. You showed me this picture you wanted to show your boy. It wasn't that hot, racy, and saucy of a picture. It's just a nice picture.
Okay, so I have to say it was a pretty hot picture, but it wasn't like nude or anything.
Yeah, you could put that on the internet and have people see it and not be really embarrassed by it.
Someone could
put up a picture like that and not be worried that people would see it. It was a good picture.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. But you did threaten me. Well, you didn't threaten, but you were like, yeah, you want me to put that up on?
I know, but I was only teasing you because I know you didn't. I know you were feeling sensitive about it.
Yeah.
But you know I would never do that.
It worked out really well, though.
All right. Well, that's good news.
Yeah, thanks.
All right, Jamie. Well, see you next week on Amarillo. Amarillo. How do you say it?
I would totally say Amarillo, even though I know that's not right.
Amarillo by morning. Glenn Campbell. Or does he say right. Amarillo? Amarillo by morning. I think he says Amarillo.
I think so.
Yeah, all right, well, that's what we'll call it, Amarillo 203 on awesome. Better Call Saul on West Coast Project, and maybe Making a Murderer, too.
Yeah, I'll do it with you, definitely.
All right, cool.
All right.
All right, Jamie, thanks, and welcome back.
Thank you, Mike. Later. Bye.